Yeah, I think I think we talk about intersecting identities a lot. I don't know from a practice perspective that we, on whole, have figured out really how to tend to and care for people's intersecting identities. I think about that. I just was a co-author on a paper that was really a student's work, looking at the enrollment patterns of queer, mad, mentally ill, neurodivergent, and disabled students, and who also had many other salient identities. And I think we are not having conversations about how do we take the for a field that talks about the whole student, we really struggle, I think, today to get to the whole student. And I understand that's because we have a lot of them, but I really think that we have to look at that from a practice perspective. And how do we, in my role, how do I help prepare practitioners to not just think about, here's the Pride Center and I might want to go work there, or here's the, Office of Multicultural Student Services, and I might want to go work there. And I think the final thing that I would say is we can't go to a place where DEI folks and DEI offices are the only ones doing this work, right? We just can't.
Hello, and welcome to Student Affairs Now, the online learning community for student affairs educators. I'm your host, Rochelle Pope, and I'm also joined today by co-host Michael Almond, who you will hear from in just a bit. Today, we're discussing ACPA's leadership in the queering of higher education. This is part of a 13-episode series for ACPA's 100th anniversary and a partnership between ACPA and Student Affairs Now. We have three amazing guests today, Jonathan Pillard, Becky Elkins, and Q Hutchins, to talk about this topic, the association's history, and our future in boldly transforming higher education. Student Affairs Now is the premier podcast and online learning community for thousands of us who work in, alongside, or adjacent to the field of higher education and student affairs. We release new episodes every week on Wednesdays. Find details about this episode or browse our archives at studentaffairsnow.com. Today's episode is sponsored by ACPA, an independent 501c3 nonprofit association, which is sponsoring this special 13-episode series with Student Affairs Now to celebrate its 100th anniversary of boldly transforming higher education. As I mentioned, I'm your host, Rochelle Pope. My pronouns are she and her, and I'm a professor in the Higher Education and Student Affairs program at the University of Buffalo. And I also serve as a Senior Associate Dean for Faculty and Student Affairs and the Unit Diversity Officer for the Graduate School of Education. I'm recording today near the University of Buffalo's campus on the unceded land of the Haudenosaunee people.
Thank you for the introduction, Rochelle. And I'm your co-host, Michael Almond. My pronouns are he, him, his. I'm currently a program coordinator in the Department of Student Volunteerism and Service at Kennesaw State University, where I encourage college students to get involved with community engagement activities off campus. I'm recording today from Kennesaw, Georgia, which is the ancestral homelands of the Yuchi and Cherokee East people. So let's get this conversation started. We're grateful to welcome all three of our guests, and we're gonna have them introduce themselves right now. So please introduce yourself with your pronouns and a land acknowledgement, and then just share a little bit about yourself and how you're entering this conversation today. So I'll start with you, Becky.
Thanks, Michael. My name is Becky Elkins. I use she, her pronouns. I am coming to you from Coralville, Iowa, land stolen from the Ochete Shkoan, Meskwaki, Kiakapoi, and Baksowich. I'm an associate professor in student affairs administration at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, which is occupying the lands of the Ho-Chunk peoples. I'm a cisgender white woman who is loving life in my 50s. So that's how I'm showing up today. But I think most importantly, today I identify as an out proud lesbian, and I owe much of my ability to say that and to claim my identity, of course, to, you know, sort of good old development theory, but also to ACPA. And so I'm really excited to be here for this conversation. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Becky. Next, I'll have Jonathan introduce himself.
Hello, everyone. Jonathan Poulard coming to you from Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, in the state of Jalisco, home of the Huichol people of both Jalisco and Nayarit. I use he, him, his pronouns. I am a longstanding member of the beloved ACPA. I have been in the profession, or was in the profession, for over 30 years. For the last 10, 11, I have been working as the president of the Equity Consulting Group. We provide senior leadership development trainings across the world. I'm very happy to be doing that healing work. While in ACPA, I was a part of the standing committee and was a proud chair of what was then the standing committee, now the coalition. And how am I showing up? I'm just happy to be alive. I'm very grateful. And I'm very grateful to be a part of this, I think, very necessary conversation. I think history is so contextual and so important to us. We often forget it. So to be able to talk about this with you all in this very inclusive way feels very warming to me. So thank you for having me.
Thank you, Jonathan. And last, we'll have Courtney introduce themselves.
So hello, everyone. My name is Courtney Hutchings. I usually go by Q. My pronouns are they, them, theirs. I'm assistant professor in higher education at Northern Illinois University, which is built on the traditional lands of the Sioux, the Potawatomi, Sauk, and Meswaki and Peoria people. I'm also very much indebted in thinking very much about unceded lands and thinking about the ways around how we ought to be reminded the ways we take up and occupy spaces for Indigenous folks. I think what I'm coming to this conversation, I always say I might be newer to ACPA. I started ACPA in 2019. We got that phrase called "I'm not new to this," but I'm new, but I'm also true to this work, particularly in ways around centering queer and trans folks. I identify as Black, queer, non-binary, which is also has been ways around how my presentation as masculine has also centered in different ways around this binary notions of language and gender. And so that's also been very much reminded for myself through not only my scholarship and my research, but also how I'm coming to this conversation, thinking in ways about intersections of our identities often come up in around historical moments, particularly for us within the association and queer people in general. So those are things that I'm thinking about right now.
Well, what an exciting opportunity to talk with you all. The conversations that we could have just from your introductions is amazing. But I thought perhaps for our viewers, we should back up a little and talk about this history and this context that Jonathan mentioned in particular. So what we were thinking was, how about we share some of the history of LGBTQ plus or queer issues in higher education? I think we can use ACPA's leadership in queer and higher education as a loose proxy for the experiences of other higher education and student affairs professional associations and the fields of higher education and student affairs themselves. And so I was wondering if we can use the history and examples from the Coalition of Gender and Sexual Identities, formerly the Standing Committee for LGBT Awareness, as a place to begin. So so how about we get you to start us off there, Jonathan?
I'd be happy to. So again, I'm very familiar with our beautiful history. For those who don't know, we were the standing committee for first lesbian and gay awareness. There was no B. It was gay and lesbian awareness. This was in the mid-1980s. And Jamie Washington and Vernon Wall and Mary McGee, Jim Croteau, Amy Reynolds, some of our first founders who came together in a very small little rooms inside the convention hotels, sort of invited space to create this little small but mighty group of folk. It was Mary McGee who pushed for the inclusion of bisexual folks. So we began our identity in the 80s as the Standing Committee for Lesbian, Gay, and Bisexual Awareness. I came into this understanding of this association in the late 80s. I was a little coordinator in residence life at Penn State, way back in the day. And I went to my first ACPA convention. And of course, Jamie Washington was there to greet me. He became my mentor. He's now one of my closest friends. We've been in this work together for more than 35 years. I can't even say that out loud, but yes, more than 35 years. And it was at that time that I became very heavily involved in the standing committee, which was, it was called at the time. I was lucky to become a coordinator. It was also during this time that we sort of stole from the standing committee for women, how we would set ourselves up and how we would make ourselves known in the association. The Standing Committee for Women had a very strong network and a very strong understanding of governance for how they ran their group. We basically said, let's just steal with pride. And we basically copied that same model for growing out the Standing Committee's directorate. It was in the mid-90s, early 90s and mid-90s, that we actually began having our summer meetings and basically using an equity model where people just, whatever the cost was, we divided by the number of members, again, took this right from the Standing Committee for Women, and met on campuses where we could actually have free housing so that all of us could get to the Standing Committee mid-year meeting, because most of us were young professionals who had no budget for professional development. So this is a way for us to actually meet, do the work, and grow. It was under the tenure of Julie Elkins, who actually helped to push us to think about the inclusion of he in our names. This was the midnight. So like 95, 96. It was, you would have thought the world was getting ready to come unglued. Just as hard as the B was to add, the T was equally hard. And during our summer meeting in Boston, while I was the chair of the standing committee, we went and got ourselves educated. And I remember penning a letter in the then Developments, which was a newspaper at the time. It was not online. It was a newspaper. I penned a letter with the help of the director to explain why we wanted to add the T. We had gone to this Center for Transgender Awareness. We had long in-depth conversations around what that would mean for us. And the then governance structure in which I sat wanted us to become the Standing Committee of Sexual Orientations. We were like, no, we are not. That's not what this is. So transgenderism is not about sexual orientation per se. We got to break this apart. We got to add the T. And they were more concerned about our name becoming too long, as opposed to really thinking through why we felt it was so important to add that T to our names. And so it was. It was also during Julie's tenure that the big gay dance began, with five literally Black gay men voguing, having a vogue contest at the then Social. That is how that happened. I was there. We had a boom box. Someone had got the boom box to then have our Social, which then became one of the biggest premier events of the association, not just for the standing committee or the coalition, but for the entire association. So that was, again,
that was pretty amazing. Let me just say that was pretty amazing, because this went from a small sort of dance Social to this big voguing thing to it being a place to be seen. So if you're an inspiring leader, yes, and you wanted to show that you were an ally to this, you had to be there.
Had to come. You had to make an appearance. You just had to. And even after I stopped being the chair, I was tired of the big gay dance, but I had to make an appearance. I had to go and show my face and walk around with all these young folks who I didn't even know anymore, but I had to go. So that's just what you did. You go show your face. So off I would go. It was also then that Tony Kearney in 97, 98 said we should have a drag show. This was another big pivotal moment in our little association's history. So I was like, okay, that's interesting. Let's think about that. I was very afraid for our young professionals. I was very fearful that if we had the drag show, they might not get jobs. Mm-hmm. Again, this was the 90s, right? And so it was not what it was now. And so we said, okay, we'll do it. Our first one being in Atlanta, as long as we do it offsite. So we made sure that that event took place. That way, if people went, they knew where they were coming to. They were coming to a gay bar to see us and be in our world. So if you're choosing to go there, that's different than happening upon it at the convention. That was the thinking, right? And it actually began to then spawn not only our sort of power in the association, but sort of reclaiming that how we show up and how we take up space is not in these monolithic ways, that there are multiple ways that we can show up and take space and be seen and be known and be understood. That was really why we did this. And so now I'm very happy that the cabaret is still in existence, some whatever many years later, but that was its beginning. And it was also then that we really sort of started to think through how can we position ourselves to be in collaboration with the then other standing committees. Mm-hmm. So it was our standing committee and the Standing Committee for Multicultural Affairs that began the first coalitions coming together to think about how we broker power of marginalized voices in the association, mm-hmm. right? So we had our own meetings. We would all come together and think about our shared agendas that needed to be on the docket for the association. At the time, all five of us sat on the governing body. That was before they changed the structure of the organization. So I was an actual member of the governing board or the executive committee, as it was called, as the chair of the standing committee. And we wanted to make sure that it wasn't just because we recognized the intersectionality of how we showed up and how we took up space. And many of us were members of multiple standing committees. We may have had a home in one, but we were actually part of many. So that just gives you an overview of then. And quite honestly, I'm going to need help because I have no idea when we became a coalition. By that point, I had left the association because I left UC Berkeley in 2013 as the dean of students. So I don't know when that happened, but it happened somewhere after that.
Well, there were two other things that happened in there. That was a very, what it gave with those voices that were often marginalized, a very big seat on that governing board, on that executive board. We had a real voice because we had come together. Now, there were two other things, and I think this might, I'm not sure if this overlaps with Becky's time period. I mean, because she picks up where you left. I think she was there with you too, but she picks up. But there was this whole, the AIDS Memorial and the experience of AIDS in the community. And I remember, I don't remember who began that, but that started again as a small room. We demanded that we have that experience because there were so many people there and in higher education community that were losing people. And then it turned into one of the biggest events at the conference again. Yeah. And then it was later changed to be a memorial for anyone who had passed away.
But I'm wondering, so that was Val de Montier. And that was Julie Bell, well, at the time, Julie Bell Elkins.
Yep.
Julie Elkins and Val de Montier were the ones who really pushed for having the AIDS Memorial. And we actually then named a fund after Val, after he died of cancer, so that he would always sort of be remembered in that space in that way. So the Standing Committee at the time had scholarship funds set aside in his name and in honor of what he was able to do to bring. And this again was late 80s, early 90s that this came to the fore, right? And again, it kind of morphed into an annual memorial for the association. Okay. And before that happened, though, there was much consternation to change it to an association-wide memorial. And we pushed back and we said, no, we're not going to do an association-wide memorial. No, we must hold space for the impact in the pandemic that is AIDS. Yep. And we're not letting this go. So again, I don't know when that transitioned to an association-wide memorial, but up until at least 1999, 2000, it was the AIDS memorial.
Okay. So Becky, maybe you can help us from here on out, share your experience and where the association has gone since then.
Yeah, that's great. I want to pause though, and just, I think it's really important to note the courage that it took for folks to step forward in a professional association, right? And you know, demand and claim a right to be there. And I think about that in the context of the formation, right? With the formation that Jonathan just talked about, that's happening in 1984, 1985, right? The first time that AIDS was a front page news article in the New York Times was 1983. These things are happening, you know, at a very similar time. And you see, here's why I think about this. I have myself a queer child, And my poor child just recently graduated from college, and we have to have this conversation all the time about when I was early on doing this work, there were no gay folks on TV. There were no, you know, there was no Queer Eye. There was no, right? There was no Bravo channel, right? These things were not the culture or the context in which all of this was happening. So I think it's important to note the association history, but also to put it in context of what's happening societally in the US and the globe as well. And I think to pair with that, the ostracization that happened of student affairs professionals who either stepped forward and advised at the time lesbian and gay student organizations, particularly those that where their campuses, where they sued their campuses for recognition, right? Those folks were ostracized regardless of their own identity.
Right.
They lost jobs, they lost opportunities for promotion. And so I think there's a great article by Michael Hubble and Tim Kaine that just came out in 2022, looking at Stephen Linton's story, who was at Virginia Commonwealth, I believe is the place. And so, you know, I think to just pause and really honor the courage that it took to step forward and step into that space and claim it. I was a young professional in the 1990s. I attended my first ACPA in 2000. I was stunned. I remember signing up and I was absolutely stunned that there was a standing committee for LGBT folks. And I had been working in the mid-90s alongside graduate assistants at the Texas A&M, working to provide support services for lesbian, gay, and we did manage to add bisexual, but we were unsuccessful adding the T to that, though we tried several times. So I'd been working there. This was before there was a campus pride organization, right? It was difficult to find space where you were the only professional doing this work on your campus. It was difficult to find space to connect with people on your campus. And so you had to look outside of your campus. And those resources weren't readily available. They weren't readily available at the professional associations I was part of. And so when I went to ACPA and I found the standing committee, and I went to my first meeting of that standing committee, and it was standing room only. Mm-hmm. That was amazing to me. It was amazing. And for me, then ACPA became home. It was literally in that moment. I remember standing in that room and listening to folks talk about why they wanted to be the directorate chair, and thinking, this is my home. These are my people. Where have you been all along? And so that the organization really became my home. It was the first time I felt seen and heard and felt like I could be in a space where at the time I identified as bisexual, I could say that out loud and be accepted and not. I still worried about job security, and I worried about what my, at the time I was in my doctoral program, what my faculty were going to think of me and what my, my then partner was going to think of. I had all sorts of worries. You know, I think that was essential. It was an essential space. And then you sort of move forward and think about all the ways in which we have made promises that we haven't lived up to. And so I think about the conversations about the ways in which we have added trans to the name, but we have not actually lived up to, I think, some of the assertions that we make as an association. And so to really watch and be part of the wrestling with those conversations, I think for me, also demonstrated not only is this a place where you can claim that space, but you have to learn to pull, you have to learn to pull apart the ways in which we've thought about and identified that space as we continue to grow and evolve. And I think, you know, associations develop just like people do. And I think that that's some of what I've seen at ACPA.
Yeah. You know, I really appreciate that, Becky, because especially the honoring of the courage. And I also think about those people who were before these people, because I do believe that the history says that before this group that we've already named as these founders who said, okay, I've got that, there were people before them who were saying,
yes,
I can't, or I risk too much, or I did this, and created a space where we could begin. And so, you know, I really appreciate you stopping to honor those.
Yeah. Let me just add one more thing there too. And speaking about the courage, I forgot to mention Joe Campbell.
Yes.
Who followed me as the chair. Joe was the keeper of names.
Yep.
This is critically important to our history. Because people were so afraid about being out, she kept a separate database for over 20 years of people who were on our standing committee.
Yep.
Just so their names would not be in the association's database and they could receive the resources that they needed to feel supported as LGBT folk. I mean, I think about that and just how she kept that safe. She was the only person. We didn't even know as directorate members who was on that list. Only Joan.
Yeah.
Right. Pretty so amazing. To keep that. Yeah. Yeah. I know I get chills thinking about her role there for that length of period of time.
And then we move into the more recent with Q, you know, joining us in 2019. Tell us about you and how you see the association or how you came into it or whatever.
Yeah, I came into the association as a practitioner, but also was a recent doctoral student. Mm-hmm. I had worked previously in LGBTQIA work at my institution where I got my doctorate. And I was really trying to find a space where I could really be seen. And that space, and during that time in 2019, I always said I was in my he, him days before I came out as non-binary. But I remember coming to ACPA, and there was just this sense of weight that was lifted off of me. There was a space where I saw so many different types of queer folks from many different intersections. And there was a space where you would have conversations where you felt like you didn't have to be something that you weren't. And I remember going to cabaret and people were talking about this thing called cabaret. And I was like, how is there a drag show like at a conference? And they were like, no, you just have to go. You just have to go. And I remember going there, and I had been at drag shows before in other, you know, other spaces personally, but to go there in association felt like they were centering our community in such beautiful ways. And to also see faculty, I remember seeing one of my faculty members performing, and I just screamed. It screamed kind of like Tom and Jerry. And just to see the representation, but also seeing practitioners, seeing students, seeing just history in that space was really profound. And it gave me some thought to process of like who this has been here for, have been here for a significant amount of time. There must have been folks who were here beforehand to make sure that this place like existed. Mm-hmm. And so that made me think about in my first ACPA, what are the ways around how history also is important for us to recognize and acknowledge that if it wasn't for me to be there in 2019, it meant that folks in the 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s were there because of this space. And so I think now that I've been in this space for a few years, I'm often thinking about the ways how queerness is very much interconnected into different coalitions. So now you see multiple folks, multiple spaces across different coalitions around queer representation. on directorate boards, on these different commissions and coalitions, that is really due to the work of folks from a historical perspective. And so I've been thinking a lot about like what is the intersections of queerness looks like, that is not just also in CGSI, but also how does it permeate in other spaces, across the association.
Yeah, thank you all for that historical context with ACPA in mind. I know I'm someone who's very new to the association as well, and so just having that background is really impactful for me in understanding, you know, what were the struggles and the difficulties it did take to get to where ACPA is today. And I think it's really telling of where the association has come from and where it's still going to today. And now I want to transition the conversation a little bit. I know we've been having a lot of conversation about ACPA itself, but we also want to talk about just higher education as a whole, and specifically how queer issues have evolved from where they were a couple of decades ago to where they are now. So I just love to learn from your perspectives, what are the current needs of queer students on campus? Maybe it'd be about queer student affairs professionals or just faculty talking about these topics in the classroom. Kind of what's the situation going on with that on college campuses right now? How do you see it from your perspectives?
Well, I was just going to say, I think this is an excellent question. And I also think it's a big question, right? I think it's, there's a lot to this question. And I have a lot of thoughts about students and student affairs educators, but one thing I want to make sure that we get into the conversation is, as I mentioned, I live in Iowa, I work in Wisconsin. These are two states where currently there is a lot of anti-DEI legislation taking place. And folks are really being impacted in terms of their work by that legislation. And so for me, as a faculty member, the thing I want to throw out and make sure we address is that there's a continued fight for the academic freedom to engage in scholarship that focuses on our queer folk and to bring these issues into the classroom, right? I think that is very much under the the political onslaught, and I think also to add to that, to not just bring the topics to the classroom, but to be able to do so through relevant critical theories, right? To be able to talk about critical race theory, queer theory, crip theory, and to embed that in the ways in which we do this scholarship and in the ways in which we then teach it in our classrooms. And that, I think, I want to make sure that it's also clear that that's not just student affairs folks, right? We're talking about all sorts of academic disciplines where faculty's ability to do that, I think, is not very far from being seriously questioned as we go down this path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, what would you add to that? Because when you said that, you talked about the onslaught, what's coming, you know, we were getting to a point, you know, and I think we got too comfortable with thinking that it's easier for queer students. And I'm thinking about that traditional age student, though I certainly mean it for everyone, to come out, to be experienced. And we know it's not as easy as it seems, or as television is making it seem, right? But, right. And the media in general. But this anti-DEI thing is throwing that back. And it's again telling these young folks in particular, it's not okay to be you. And it's not okay to think this way in ways that we hadn't heard everywhere with the same virulence that we are hearing now. So I'm wondering what else are their needs?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we can even frame this more broadly a little bit in the context of what I feel is a strong period of contraction and evolution, And the tension point between us contracting as a world, not even just in the US context, let's just move ourselves outside of our little centric view of the US and think about the rise of nationalism and think about the rise of on the right, on the left, you're wrong, I'm right, up, down, yes, no, black, white. If you even think about that fear that is permeating the call for the contraction, because we are actually evolving. And I actually attribute the trans community with a lot of that evolution. They have literally blown up binary. They have said, no more. We're not going to do either or anymore. We're not doing it. So if that's what you're setting us up for, we're not here for it, right? So in some ways, we have communities of people that are, and isn't it interesting that those folk who comprise less than, what, 2% of our population are all the legislation are against them? Really?
Yes.
Just think about how this is being framed. So when I think about it in the context of a campus, by the way, I've not been on a campus. Let me put this out there for the last 10 years. Good on you all. You all rock that out. I love it. You all go do all the things. You all go do all the things. Because UC Berkeley wore me out as the Dean of Students. You all rock that out. But I do get to come back in as an interloper doing training for senior leaders who are then responsible for the education, the direction of students, right, and their holistic well-being. And what I see them struggling with is how they have conversation to hold that container of contraction and evolution. Yep. And our inability to do so does not allow our students to experience what we say, which is their developmental well-being holistically. Mm-hmm. So if we got, so for us, for me, the work is from the inside out. Where are you contracting? Where are you evolving? And where are you bumping up against other folks who are simultaneously evolving and contracting?
Yeah.
Right. So that is, again, where I spend most of my energy helping leaders think through how am I going to show up and how am I going to take up space to allow for that breath and not shut things down.
Yep.
As we move towards fear-based thinking of the legislation of the, don't even get me started.
I think it's super pointing that you both are sharing this contraction versus evolution, because I keep on thinking about what happens to, I think as an early career faculty member, I'm often reminded of like supporting the students who are getting ready to become student affairs professionals, and how they're living in this this contradictions versus evolution in the middle of it. And often where there are students who a lot of our doctoral students, master students who are very much wanting to be in the nexus of change, how they're being met with dissonance and divisiveness, and how that's often, particularly even for queer folks who are living those intersections, how do we often have to navigate those spaces? How do we navigate? I was talking to a recent alum, and we were having conversations about him starting his first job and where he can find queer community, particularly in the South, and how that impacts him in particular ways. And even though his campus may be queer affirming, but you also think about sometimes people's outside spaces may not be. And also you think about different intersections, you know, differences between folks who identify as white versus folks who are white or marginalized in different other ways. And so I'm often just reminded of this continuously feels like a force that is like resisting to us, when we have also, when trans folks, non-binary, like so many folks have been trying to resist against that force that is pushing us towards liberation in those ways. I'm often reminded of like these pockets of bubbles that are often can be really challenging for us to navigate.
That's right. Key, what did you say? Pockets of,
like I feel like I just had a Dory moment from Finding Nemo.
I just couldn't hear the word.
I thought it was pockets of liberation, pockets of like freedom. That often, I think as queer folks, we often find for ourselves, we also curated, we created ourselves, that other folks in a lot of ways benefit from that. And so I think there's ways around how do we also keep our own protective bubbles where spaces are really kept for us and by us.
Yep. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that that's true of marginalized groups as they push for themselves. It's that whole thing about the rising, you raise the tide for everyone or whatever, all the ships rise, you know, and I think we sometimes miss that. We think there's a special thing there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing I would add to Jonathan, your point about contraction is what I see that concerns me more than anything is silence among senior leaders as those presidential cabinets, chancellor cabinets, you know, those are the places where I think for a time it's been somewhat safe for folks to advocate for the needs of queer students and staff and faculty. And I think as we see sort of this force coming back, one of my concerns is that we respond to it with silence. And I think that takes us back into our history as opposed to what I want to see is I want folks to not abdicate the responsibility to keep speaking simply because it feels unsafe to do so. And I think that's particularly true for those of us in privileged identities. And we haven't, you know, we haven't really named it. That's, you know, we don't all come to this space with sort of, you know, the same capacity to push back against that force, as you're mentioning, Q. And I think that's important to also name and recognize. And it's my hope that folks will continue to speak regardless of the concerns of doing so.
Yeah. And let's not forget, though, and this is, again, I want to remind us, just because I move into senior or more leadership does not mean I have developed my skills and my capacities to engage True. Well. Yes. And coupled with that is because we're in a period of contraction, there is this blaming that happens. And I am not taking, yeah. So if we go back to Amy Edmondson's psychological calculator, right? Where she kind of talks about my silence will protect me. If I speak, I don't even know if my speaking is going to matter. But I know when I am silent, I'm going to be the one protected, regardless of where I sit position. It's not mean I ignore positional authority around race, class, gender, size, ability, class, positionality. That's real. And where is our, for me, we're only going to get to this next phase of evolution as far as I see it and how we support LGBTQ students with humility and with some damn compassion. Mm-hmm. In the absence of it, I don't see another way forward. I really don't. It's like, yes, and you have responsibility because you are the vice president. Yep. And where is my humility around? One of the things that always has concerned me in the DEI space is this wokeness. I believe I am woke about some things. I say that we're in a constant state of awakening.
Yep.
I might be woke about this. I know nothing about that.
Right.
And so my capacity to hold humility around what don't I know? And like you said then, Becky, and then take the risk to still speak up.
Well, and let's not forget what Audre Lorde told us years and years ago, you know, as we just celebrated her birthday, our silence really doesn't protect us. Our silence will not protect us. And so you believe there's this veneer that says our silence is protecting us. It's not. It's not protecting you. Not protecting the people that you're not speaking out for. So, Michael, I think you were headed somewhere.
Oh, yes. So we kind of already started this conversation about, you know, what needs to happen in the future in order for any progress to get started. And so our question is just, what queer issues do you believe will be the most pressing for practitioners to address in the future? And I'm thinking, you know, based on what we already talked about, it could be all the way up from the vice president who is in charge, as you mentioned, Jonathan, all the way down to how we're preparing future practitioners in grad school, as Q had mentioned. So I'm just curious to know what are the things that we need to be looking out for?
This is Some of the things I keep on being reminded of is, I think as a faculty member, as I move farther in, I lose some of the practitioner pieces in some ways, right? Right. It's kind of like if you don't use it, you don't, you know, if you don't use it, you lose it. But I am often reminded of how, where's the nexus of scholarship and practice meet? Because I also am reminded the folks are queer practitioners, queer and trans and non-binary practitioners are really on the front lines the way they always have been, in front of historical movements and those different pieces. And so when I think about some of the pressing issues, I think about housing. I think a lot about housing insecure. I think about food insecurity. I often think about the ways around how queer students or practitioners are often helping queer and trans students navigate harm by faculty. Things that are happening, you know, even with other senior administrative leaders that often are still living in this binary multiverse, and often just not necessarily moving past expansive notions of gender and sexuality, even from a racialized ways. And so I've been thinking about how do we think about not moving past, but really holding folks accountable, and not just moving past people being obviously it's important to name around, you know, filing for complaints and all those different pieces, but folks are protected, particularly senior leaders, particularly tenured faculty, right? And there's no consequences. And I think that we as a field and as association need to also think about what are some ways that we're also holding people accountable when harm is being done. Because the folks that are often having to pick up those pieces are our queer and trans practitioners that often have to sit with those pieces and still have to go back to their own homes and their own communities and still processing all of these things that are happening. So those are things that I'm thinking.
Well, you know, I hate to use silence, you know, because I know that meant I was just marshaling my thoughts, right? But, you know, we are getting close to the end. And, you know, there's so much that we can continue to talk about, but I just want to give each of you a chance to just say one more thing that you want to make sure that didn't get said yet, you didn't have a chance to say, but that you think is important as we think about this discussion. And Becky, I'm going to ask you to start us off if you'd like.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think we talk about intersecting identities a lot. I don't know from a practice perspective that we, on whole, have figured out really how to tend to and care for people's intersecting identities. I think about that. I just was a co-author on a paper that was really a student's work looking at the enrollment patterns of queer, MAD, mentally ill, neurodivergent, and disabled students, and who also had many other salient identities. And I think we are not having conversations about how do we take the, for a field that talks about the whole student, we really struggle, I think, today to get to the whole student. And I understand that's because we have a lot of them, but I really think that we have to look at that from a practice perspective. And how do we, you know, in my role, how do I help prepare practitioners to not just think about, here's the Pride Center and I might want to go work there, or here's the, you know, Office of Multicultural Student Services and I might want to go work there. And I think the final thing that I would say is we can't go to a place where DEI folks in DEI offices are the only ones doing this work, right? We just can't. So those are the things that are really sort of ruminating for me, Rochelle.
Yeah,
I would piggyback on Becky's, and I'm thinking about Michael right now, who's in civic engagement and learning, So we often go to those people to do that work. And this is coming from a former director of multicultural affairs, which I thought was a bankrupt job, but I digress. So in that work, all the stuff had to come to me. So back to Q's perspective around the emotional taxation that we pay from a marginalized identity perspective, we're always going to pay that. Here's my offer, or here's what I would really want to lean into. Lean into your privilege, not into the marginalization. I am a privileged individual. I have class privilege. I have male privilege. I have identity privilege around being able-bodied. I got a lot. And if I spend all of my time just focused on where I don't, I tend not to see the full spectrum for how I leverage and how I show up. So from the inside out, how emotionally am I aware not only of my own taxation, but the taxation that I cause?
Yep.
Yeah. I'm causing taxation on women folk. I am causing taxation on lesbian folk, even as a gay man. So where is that? Where is my work from the inside out with some level of humility and grace, regardless of what other folks are doing? To me, this is the biggest part. This is the outward mindset part. So I don't care what Michael or Q or Rochelle's going to do. What am I going to do? And how am I going to use my own positional authority to think about where voice is and voice is not being used? Yep. So that for me, if I'm leaving people with anything, what is my work from the inside out? That's where I have the most dominion.
Yeah, that really resonates with me. I keep on thinking about when we talked about this word queering, which it to me feels like a verb. Mm-hmm. Like I very much think about, you know, when Tyra and Mary's Next Time Model says, like, you're not a model, you're modeling. Like you're not a noun, you're a verb, you're action, you're moving. And I think often, as we know, queer and trans, non-binary folks have always been the verb. We've always been the actor, we've always been moving. And I keep on thinking about what happens that we're a space of deserving of rest.
Yeah.
Like what happens when we get a chance to center community, healing, our own healing, our own joy, our own laughter. Where do we get the space to also be centered, where it's not being from a place of us having to be the answer?
Yeah.
Right. And so I'm often trying to be reminded, I think, of ways around similar, like Becky and Jonathan have shared around, like, my own privilege as a faculty member. How am I also thinking about ways to center, have our, you know, queer practitioners and administrators really be centered in the research process? What does it mean to pay them? And, like, really, like, you know, as Beyonce said, pay them in equity, you know, let them reverse out of debt. This is like life. Like this is people whose lives have been put on the line to change campuses that are often being erasured and being silenced. And so I'm often being reminded of really doing a call of action from folks from privileged identities to pay us. And pay us not and just, you know, just an award, but actually pay us financially, pay us through professional development, all these other pieces that we're needing, that you know, we're often being left siloed in those ways. And so those are things that I'm thinking about as well.
Yeah. Save the pizza party. You know, think about how you give me that seat at the table, right? Right. So I'm hearing that. Yeah, go ahead, Michael. You look like you were going to say something.
Oh, I was just going to say thank you to all of you for sharing your wisdom with us today. I hope all the listeners are also going to be as, I guess, I don't know. I'm a little speechless because I'm still processing a lot of these thoughts. So just thank you again.
Yeah, this has been an amazing conversation. We could have done this for so much longer. I am just overflowing with the things that I'd like to say. I also want to send a shout out to not only you all, but we had another panelist who was going to join us today, Cole Eskridge. And Cole got, as we do in student affairs, got called in 10 minutes before we began to say, you know, he had to take care of something on campus. And so I just want to, I'm sorry, I don't even know if I misgendered them. I don't remember. I hadn't met Cole yet, but I just wanted to say a shout out to Cole for all the prep that he did Cole did to be part of this conversation. And so I want to send a thanks there. I also want to thank our sponsors of today's episode, ACPA. ACPA, College Student Educators International, is celebrating its 100th anniversary and is boldly transforming higher education by creating and sharing influential scholarship, shaping critically reflective practice, and advocating for equitable and inclusive learning environments. ACPA aspires to be higher education and student affairs' most inclusive and community-driven association by leading our profession in centering social justice, racial justice, and decolonization as defining concepts of our time and the foreseeable future. ACPA's annual convention is March 18th through the 21st. In Chicago. So, hey, make some plans if you haven't already to be there. We would love to see you. Visit myacpa.org or connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, X, to learn more about ACPA. And of course, I want to send a huge shout out to our producer, Natalie Ambrosi, who does all of the behind the scenes work to make us all look and sound so good. Hey, we love the support of these important conversations from our community, and you can help us reach even more folks by subscribing to our podcast, our YouTube channel, and weekly newsletter, which announces each new episode and more. So if you're so inclined, you can also leave us a 5-star review. I'm Rochelle Pope with Michael Allman. Thanks again to our amazing, amazing panelists today, and to everyone who's watching and listening. Let's make it a great week, folks.